I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ruler is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Ruler interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at ruler.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Ruler and this is Ruler Conversations. And I'm joined today by James Start, Ruler's roving photojournalist who has roved all the way to the Basque Country. What are you doing there, James?
I hear there's a little bike race going on called the Tour de France that's starting here in northern Spain in the Basque Country. And I've been looking forward to the start for quite a long time and took the train down to Biarritz from Paris and then rented my car and drove across and just got here, really. So building up for what will be my 34th Tour de France.
Have you been to the Basque Country much before?
I've been here for the San Sebastian race a couple times. I've been here for a couple of different visits with the bike industry. Bilbao is a great town. I love walking around down here, going to the Guggenheim and walking along the river.
So James and I are going to talk about this year's Tour de France, which starts on Saturday in the Basque Country. I did actually know that, James. We're going to talk a bit about the favourites, about the terrain especially, but we're also going to talk a bit more about our memories of the race. Just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to Ruler and get 15% off the usual price by going to ruler.cc/subscribe and entering the code podcast15. And the new edition of Ruler, the Tours de France edition, is out now, packed full of fascinating features, in-depth journalism, great interview by James with Tadej Pogacar, me waxing lyrical about the Puy de Dôme, and much, much more. But let's get on to this year's Tour de France. James, who is going to win?
Well, if it's a one-word answer, it would be Pogacar for me.
Explain.
Ah, it's not a one-word answer.
I've got a three-word answer, which is Pogacar or Vingegaard. You've been saying for some time that you think Pogacar will have recovered fine from his wrist breakage. I know you're a big fan of his racing style, and you think he's going to win. I tend to agree with you, but I do think that the wrist injury does complicate things a little bit. The recovery takes energy and time, and it's suboptimal. So that's why I think it's between the two of them. But it is true that most people do see this as a two-horse race, don't they?
They do. And for good reason. These are, for the last 2 years, the two biggest talents in the Tour. And they've just been going at it head-to-head. Whatever race they show up at, Vingegaard or Pogacar just sort of dominate the rest of the field. So we have all the makings of a really epic duel. On paper, that's what we're looking at. One of the great rivalries, I think, in modern cycling. And it's going to be exciting. But I just think that Pogacar has the edge. And I'm going to perhaps be overconfident, but that he's going to have recovered. But if you ask me who do I think is my gut favorite, it would be Pogacar.
So Vingegaard beat Pogacar last year by 2 minutes 43 seconds, which is quite a significant gap. That gap was a big one. But we talked about this a lot in the early parts of last year's Tour, James, when Pogacar was riding very aggressively, putting a lot of efforts out while Vingegaard was just tapping around as well as he could and not showing his cards. I think that gap was not indicative of the physical gap between them. It was more indicative of the way they rode their races. So that being taken into mind, do you think Vingegaard is stronger than Pogacar? Do you think Pogacar is stronger than Vingegaard in a straight race without strategy tactics?
I think pure test of strength is why I lean towards Pogacar. He made one very bad mistake last year, and that cost him the race. And it was a blunder. And he admits it. You know, when we talked about it in our interview, he broke it down and he said, I knew right away I was in trouble. And thinking back, I should not have followed Roglic, who made the first attack in that mountain stage. But he's not a guy that likes to sit back and let the race get up the road. And he made a mistake. But I think he's smart enough that he's learned from that. And also, this year's Tour doesn't seem to have that unworldly mega summit finish that is going to be such a game changer. And perhaps the fact that he did break this wrist, he's not going to maybe go in there firing all guns in that first week. I think he's going to have to reshape his approach to this year's race, and it could be a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, it's actually a shame for him because I think that the parkour in the first week, in fact, all the way up to the Puy de Dôme, I would say, is absolutely Pogacar favoured territory. I think he was making efforts last year when there wasn't really the terrain to make the difference on, whereas this year, you know, the Basque punchy stages in the Basque country, the Pyrenean stages are, you know, they're hard, but they're not the super tough mountain stages, which again perfectly suits Pogacar. And the Puy de Dôme, that kind of shortish effort, is right up his street. So that's what makes me interested in this year's Tour, just trying to work out how those two are going to work out the challenges and each other and the terrain. What is also true, though, is they do both seem to be clear favourites. They've both got very strong teams. Are you at all worried about it becoming a bit too controlled by those two teams?
That's true, but this is a very well-balanced race, I think, and there are a lot of crazy stages that go under the radar. There's a lot of people that don't have anything to lose either that can play well into the hands of creating suspense. There's just always so many unknowns. There's potential outsiders, and there's some people that have been showing some, you know, were showing some really good form in the races like the Criterium du Dauphiné, guys like Jai Hindley, who was coming here for the first time to do the race. Ben O'Connor was running very well at the Dauphiné. I think he's going to be back this year. He's not going to have to worry about negotiating cobbles and things like that. There are a lot of great riders. This is the Tour de France. So, I'm just excited to watch it. You know, what we don't have is a Tour de France of the 90s, where we had some momentous time trial and a guy by the name of Miguel Indurain who just steamrolled everybody and it was game over. We're not going to have that.
No, but I would point out to all our listeners that there is an interview with Miguel Indurain in the latest edition.
There is. Ruda.
Thank you very much for that link, James. So yeah, let's talk about the other guys. As you say, you can never assume at the Tour de France. All it takes is one crash or one rider to have mistimed their form or one bit of bad luck, and the first days of the Tour de France are always chaotic. It's entirely feasible that what we expect, you know, today won't even last past the first couple of stages. So let's talk about the other riders who either threaten those first two or, you know, contest that third spot on the podium. You mentioned Jai Hindley. He would be my personal choice, that third place, just because when he won that Giro, I was so impressed with him. I know he didn't beat a very, very deep field, but it was still a good field he beat, and it was a tough race. And he rode a really solid, consistent race, was clearly the strongest on the crucial stages at the end. And he's also got quite a strong team. Bora, they're not one of the super teams with massive budgets, but they punch above their weight and they're very, very clever. They've started from small beginnings and built and built and built, and they just keep on getting better. And the only place to go after winning the Giro is winning the Tour de France. So Jai Hindley is the guy I think I'm going to be watching with interest to see if he can take that third spot. Who else has caught your eye?
Already mentioned O'Connor. I think he's going very well. He was right. They were kind of right together most of Dauphiné. You know, all year long, I was thinking David Godu was going to be right there. He rode consistently well in races like Paris-Nice. I think he got third in Paris-Nice, you know. But he had a bad Dauphiné. But he was just coming off a heavy altitude camp, and he rode tremendously at the French National Championships this past weekend. I was there. So I think he's coming around, and I think he could be right there again. There's a lot of familiar faces that should be right there in the top five. I think Romain Bardet is going to be there again. Mikel Landa is starting in the Basque Country, so he's going to be a hometown favorite, and I think he's going to ride well in these first stages. And then there's this up-and-coming rider, Matthias Schelmo was from Trek, and he's got all the makings of having a great tour. I mean, he was, you know, podium at Flèche Wallonne. That's a brutal, steep climb. So he can handle those kinds of climbs like the Puy de Dôme. He hasn't been tested in the high mountains, but this year's tour doesn't have tons of that. And the guy just did win the Tour of Switzerland. So I'll be really curious to see how he holds up.
There's a few other names to chuck into the mix as well. There's Enric Mas, who has been three times second in the Vuelta, seems to scrape around fifth, sixth place in the Tour de France, and just, it's hard to know what to think about Enric Mas. When he popped up out of nowhere and came second in the Vuelta when he was still riding for Quickstep, several years ago now, I thought, well, this is a rider with real potential, and he still hasn't topped that, and seems to kind of, he's not suffering from an excess of boldness, Enric Mas. No. I don't think. I think he tends to wait to see what happens. Always a bit inconsistent, but, you know, will be there or thereabouts in most of the mountain stages. There's also the question of Ineos Grenadiers, who had third in Geraint Thomas last year, defeated narrowly at the Giro with Geraint Thomas this year. And I guess, is Bernal a leader there? They've got Tom Pidcock in the team. He's won at Alpe d'Huez last year, but he's not strung 3 weeks of stage racing together as yet, but maybe that's a good strategy for Ineos to see what he can do and see what Bernal can do.
I actually prefer Ineos when they don't have an overwhelming favorite. They race brilliantly, as we saw when Theo Gegenhardt won the Giro. We almost saw that here with Geraint in the Giro again. They know they don't have the heavy pre-race favorite, and they've done a good job in recent years of playing with their numbers and launching guys and seeing what comes up. And we'll see where it goes. It's going to be interesting. But for what it's worth, Bernal rode well at Dauphiné, and he is coming up. So, you know, he could find his legs. We'll just have to see.
I'm going to just gently disagree with you on Ineos chucking guys up the road, because in last year's tour, I think they had three or four riders in the top 15 or so. And that is numbers. They were faced with two clearly stronger guys. They were the only team with the numbers and the potential to lob a grenade into the GC. And instead, Geraint Thomas just rode around third place, which is, it's fine. That's not a criticism. That is the best possible result they could get in riding that way. But they were not prepared, after all their talk of riding it aggressively and excitingly, they were not prepared to risk third place for a possible but improbable first. And I think, you know, the same at the Giro this year, you know, Geraint Thomas's assets are that he has got incredible tenacity and strength and resilience and endurance, and that's how he rode his best race, and he just got found out a bit at the end. But Pidcock, on the other hand, does have more aggressive tendencies. He's another year older. I believe he wants to have a look at targeting the GC in Grand Tours. This would be a good tour for him to see what he can do without the pressure of being an outright favorite.
Absolutely. And he's the kind of rider who is going to shine in this opening week. I wouldn't be surprised to see him in the yellow jersey at some point in the race. He's definitely that kind of rider, like, you know, not unlike, say, Alaphilippe. These punchy opening stages are going to be really interesting, and there's just going to be a lot of opportunities for guys like Pidcock or Alaphilippe to also play their hand.
Just to finish off with the GC contenders, I'm just going to lob a few more names into the mix for you, James, and give us a quick, very quick fire, where you think they're going to come, how you think they're going to do, and why. So, Adam Yates, he has been riding well. He's got a strong team.
He rode brilliantly at the Dauphiné, got second, so he's got the legs. And UAE is one of those teams that brings out the best in riders, you got to say. When they go to the UAE, there's some real positive things happening there. And, you know, when you got a guy like Pogacar that's taken people up. It coalesces the whole team and they ride really well. Yates, obviously, it's going to depend on Pogacar, if what his options are there. But if there's any doubt with Pogacar, they might launch Yates, surprise people. Use Yates like Jumbo used Roglic, you know, into the midway through the tour last year. Launch him. Well, can Vingegaard just let Yates ride up the road? No.
And from one Yates to another, Simon Yates.
I mean, he has had the best Grand Tour results, really, but it's of the two brothers, but had some misfortune here in his build-up. So we'll just have to see where his legs come. But he's going to have freedom, which means a lot.
I was looking at his results as well, actually. I mean, he's been a pro for 10 seasons now, and in all that time, he's had one seventh place in the Tour de France, and that's his only kind of really high result in the Tour. Also, he's had four DNFs out of the last five Grand Tours he's ridden, and, you know, bad luck, injuries, illness. Just seems like, you know, he won his Vuelta, but even a Tour podium might be optimistic for him, but, you know, you never know. Couple more names. Richard Carapaz, former Giro winner, has been on the podium at the Tour de France, now running for EF. But what do you think about his chances?
Well, I thought that he was going to be real podium potential, but he was very eclectic, shall we say. Inconsistent is probably a better word. At the Dauphiné, he was one of the first guys to launch the attacks on the first climbs and then just totally folded. So we're going to have to see where that goes. But I was expecting a better performance out of him at the Dauphiné.
But it's not just about the yellow jersey competition, is it, James? It's several other stories bubbling along with this Tour de France. And the biggest one, I think, from a news point of view, is just whether Mark Cavendish can get that 35th Tour stage win. He's not had a stellar year. On the other hand, he is Mark Cavendish, and we never write him off.
You can never write off a big champion like Mark. And he just reminded us of that at the last stage of the Giro, which was one of, I think, one of his most brilliant victories, because, you know, I think there people were like, well, he's, you know, 3 weeks of the race is over and he hasn't shown it yet. Why would he be the guy to win the last stage in Giro? And then he made it look so easy. It was amazing. So he's coming in here. There are quite a few stages. We look at the state, this race as being, you know, brutally hard because we start with climbing right from the get-go. But we have 5, 6 classic sprint stages out there too, you know, so there's going to be plenty of opportunities for these guys, and it's going to be interesting to see, and Cav only needs one.
Yeah, my opinion on Mark Cavendish is I believe he can win a stage because, of course, as you say, he just knows how to do it, and he's clearly not got bad form, you know, from that Giro stage. The first sprints in the Tour are always an utter madhouse. They're dangerous. There's often a crash. There are often multiple crashes. If I were him, which obviously I'm not, and if I were, he probably wouldn't have won so many bike races. But I think that what Cavendish is good at doing is managing his effort for a Grand Tour. And he knows how to manage the mountain stages, and he knows how to keep his form. I would say those couple of early sprint stages before the Pyrenees, I think stages 3 and 4, don't get involved. Just sit back, watch, see how it's going, but mainly don't get involved. Get through the Pyrenees, and then there's those couple of stages to Bordeaux and Limoges. Start getting involved then, because there are several sprint stages. The other sprinters will be starting to get more tired as they've been through the mountains, and then he can target stages. I know he won't think like this, and I know he'll start trying to win from the beginning, like a, you know, as is his personality and what's given him a lot of success. But that's how I see his potential this Tour.
I agree with a lot of that. Mark's a historian of the sport. This year's Tour, just, you know, following what you just said, which was, I think, a very good analysis, if he kind of observes things in the first couple of sprint stages, what do you have coming around the corner? Bordeaux. And Bordeaux was, for generations, the prime sprint stage. Mark Cavendish knows this. He knows what it means to win in Bordeaux, and he's a sentimental guy. I think he's got that one down on his bucket list. And don't be surprised. It comes right about after, you know, right perfectly in timing with your Mark Cavendish crescendo. Not the first Swiss stages, but the third or fourth. Let's wait for Bordeaux and have a bottle of wine on tap and ready to celebrate.
Yeah, I would like to think that Mark Cavendish would have won a lot more races if he'd listened more to me. who else is going to win sprint stages, James?
It's a pretty good list of sprinters. What we have seen is, you know, there's not that many guys that dominate. We're not seeing these sprinters winning 3, 4, or 5 stages anymore. So I'll be kind of curious to see what happens there. We've got, obviously, Wout van Aert, or his teammate Christophe Laporte. We've got Groenewegen. We've got Jakobsen. We've got, you know, the list is long. There's some guys we haven't seen before. Jesper Philipsen, he is barely going to a race yet that he hasn't won a stage in this year. And Mads Pedersen is always right there. So I'm going to be really curious to see how Binyam Girmay does. I was hoping for more out of him in the spring, but he had really bad luck with some crashes and stuff. He had such a great year last year. He can get over climbs. He can go the 3 weeks. He's a tough sprinter. He can place himself, play off of others. I think he's going to be in the mix daily.
We were having a chat before we started recording, and you suggested that for Jumbo-Visma, if they're at all interested in the green jersey this year, after Wout van Aert won it by just hundreds of points last year, that Christophe Laporte would be more their option. And there are specific reasons for that.
Yeah, well, I was digging around a little bit. As you know, I play velo games with a group of friends from years past, and we take our velo games very seriously, I must say. I was analyzing the different riders, and I go into the results columns and see what these guys have been doing just to check up and really try to figure out who could potentially be coming around. And I came across this little interesting tidbit that, Laporte might actually be their green jersey hope. He had a tremendous Dauphiné, winning two out of the first three stages. He's strong, he's fast, he's proven. And Wout van Aert apparently is not really going to focus on that green jersey because he wants to save himself a Worlds. And he said, last year, I was not even human after the tour. I was so wasted going for everything day in and day out.
I also do not feel human at the end of the Tour de France. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to be back to talk about the route. This episode of Roulin Conversations is brought to you by GCN Plus. The Tours de France are here. They're the greatest races in the world, and you can see every unmissable moment on GCN Plus. I'm not actually going out for much of the Tours this year, so I'm really looking forward to being able to watch every stage from start to finish, ad-free. And for those days where life gets in the way of a cycling fan's real priorities, I can catch up at any time, because there are full replays of both races on demand. For the really busy, there is a selection of tailored highlights packages. You can go for long, short, or just the final kilometres. And as a cycling journalist, one of the most useful features is the ability to pause and rewind the live coverage. And this feature is great for trying to work out what's happened and why. You can also take the action with you if you're out and about. You can watch GCN Plus on any device. GCN Plus have brilliant commentators and co-commentators and an expert panel of knowledgeable ex-pros who will dissect and analyse the action, but also convey the fun and passion of the tours. And you can relive the best moments and biggest talking points on the weekly World of Cycling show, and this airs throughout the season. If that's not enough, you can get all the pre-race information you need with previews, route maps, profiles and start lists all available on the GCN app. With GCN Plus, the coverage continues all year round, with coverage of all the biggest races from the road, cyclocross, track and MTB seasons. You'll also have access to a huge collection of exclusive cycling films covering all aspects of the sport, from chats with legends through epic adventures to record-breaking challenges. There are already 150 titles, with more being added every week. A GCN subscription costs as little as the price of a cup of coffee a month, and all our listeners can get 15% off an annual GCN Plus subscription. Head to gcn.eu/ruler15 to subscribe and save 15%. We're back, Roulin Conversations. I'm Edward Pickering. I'm with James Start. We're going to be talking about the Tour de France route. And what we thought probably the best way of doing it, rather than go through it stage by stage by stage by stage, 5 minutes a stage, we're easily up to 100 minutes. We've divided it into phases. of the race. There's four kind of macro phases in this year's tour. So phase one, James, the Basque Country up to and including stage four to Nogaro. So this Basque Country Grand Départ, it's kind of a punchy, hilly, full of traps. The fans are going to be crazy. The atmosphere is going to be brilliant. I hope the weather's going to be nice. What's your angle on these first four stages?
It's going to be a real celebration of cycling here in the Basque Country. I mean, Tadej Pogačar, I asked him when I interviewed him for Ruler, I said, what stage are you most excited about or most looking forward to? And he said, stage one. It's going to be amazing with the fans and all. It's just going to be a real communion. It's going to be tricky. It's all up and down, littered with little punchy climbs.
So yeah, the first two stages especially, very punchy. These are not going to be bunch sprints, especially stage two. You know, the Heath Gabel climb's been, you know, it's been a major part of the San Sebastian Classic. It won't be a GC climb, but at the same time, you can quite easily see 20, 30 riders being away on that. And it'll be an early indicator of who is sharp, won't it? Any splits over that climb, we'll be watching very, very carefully. And then to round off the Basque stages and the stage in the southwest France, there are two flatter stages. The next phase, a very, very short one, James, because it's I've just lumped the Pyrenees into one phase. And there are two Pyrenees stages. There's one to Fompeau to La Rance, which crosses the first all-category climb of the tour, the Col de Soudé. The run-in's a bit more complicated. It's got the Col de Marie Blanc, which is only first category, but it's very, very steep. And it's where, I think, Pogačar, Bernal, Roglic, and somebody else broke away. Yeah, it's hard enough for it to be a GC climb. That's a hard stage. And I think the stage six is harder. It crosses the Col d'Aspin, but also crosses the Col du Tourmalet. And it's got the final climb up to La Cambasque above Cotteret, first summit finish of the race. So how do you view these two stages? They're obviously GC days because there are big mountains involved, but quite early in the race, or is it a good time for riders to start making statements?
Well, considering that we agree that Pogačar is not going to try to win everything in sight in the first week here, this could be a more traditional opening mountain stages where the favorites kind of look at each other. Maybe we'll see Vingegaard and his team trying to blow it open and trying to corner Pogačar early, saying, hey, there's no way you can be in as good a shape as you were at this point last year. Let's try to, you know, catch you out here.
Next phase of the race is a rather large one. I've called it the Empty France phase of the race, and it's one of our pet obsessions with, you know, the parts of France that lie between the cities and away from the coastlines. And it takes us all the way from Mont-de-Marsan, back down in the southwest of France, all the way via the Puy-de-Dôme to Bourg-en-Bresse. So we incorporate, you know, the crossing of the Landes, the Massif Central, and to the very northern edge of the Rhône Valley. It's quite a large part of the tour, this. There's a lot in it. I've just realised we've got five phases rather than four, but this is the third phase. First two stages to Bordeaux and Limoges look fairly... Bordeaux looks flat. I mean, it's uncomplicated. That's the sprint stage. Limoges, bit lumpier, but still, I don't think it's the kind of stage that will catch out any of the sprinters. So I see those two stages being probably bunch sprints. But then we have the long-awaited return on Sunday, the 9th of July. First time since 1988 of the Puy-de-Dôme. This mountain has been looming over our stage previews and our thoughts about this year's Tour de France, hasn't it?
It has. You and I went down. We did a great road trip down there for the current issue of Ruler. It was a special time to be down there. The weather was sort of... How would you have described the weather down there?
It's quite British, actually.
Yeah, okay. It was just... Splash of sun here, fog there, dash of rain. It was crazy. And going up that climb, you know, it was suddenly very quiet and there's no cars or bikes or anything. It's just this, you know, you're just alone up there. And it was a very special moment for me. I don't know what it was like for you going up there.
It's an eerie, kind of characterful climb that's got a ton of charisma and it's got a unique shape. And it's also going to be an exciting bike race because it's the engineering on the climb means that it spirals around, built on an old railway track. Because of that, it doesn't have any bends. It's got no hairpins. It's got no mitigation of the gradient. It's a 5-kilometer steep ramp test with no respite. And that's why I said earlier on that it's perfect for Pogacar, because it's that kind of intense 20-minute effort that he excels at. So, you know, the remainder of the stage is not that hard, so that there's going to be a lot of riders going into the bottom of that climb, but that's going to be a punctuation point on the end of that first half of the race. After the rest day, it goes to Issoire in a very, very archetypally Massue Central day, which covers, you know, no big climbs, but there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 categorised climbs and probably several dozen uncategorised climbs on that stage. And that's a very, very grippy, tough day in the Massue Central, followed by a likely sprint stage to Moulins, which is where I have particular memories of Moulins, James, because it's where I spent my year as an assistant anglais at a lycée as part of my French degree. And I'm really, really looking forward to the tour going back to Moulins. I can guarantee that there is no cycling journalist in the entire tour press pack who is more excited about the Moulins stage, which otherwise does look like one of the most kind of boring and kind of least eventful stages of the whole race. We never know, the wind might blow. Yes, James.
One of the things that we love about these races through the heart of central France is this part of the country is sort of lost in time. And when you're going through these stages, you feel kind of like it's the tour of old. It's really wonderful to be in that part of the country, I think, because the bicycle racing just brings so much life to that part of the world. It's, you know, daily life there is, dare I say, a bit drab. It's pretty monotone. The weather's not great. It's, you're deep in the heart of the country. I mean, it's hill land, you know. There, even when they say flat, there's no such thing as a flat road in this part of the country. And it's very rustic. And all of a sudden, the tour comes and it's this big party and it's festive and you know, with a little luck, we even get some sunshine. And it's always pretty, you know, kind of heartwarming when we go through these parts of the country. We share our love of this part of the country. You know, everybody knows the Alps are going to be great. Everybody knows the Pyrenees are going to be great. And then we come here and it's kind of sleepy and whatever. And yet it's still pretty great.
Sleepy is an apt description of Moulins. Yeah, Moulins is the last departmental capital never to have featured in the Tour de France route, and it's featuring for the first time this year. I've got nothing but happy memories of my time in Moulins. It's a town that's got, if you know where to look, it has got a ton of character, but yeah, it's a small sleepy town lost in the middle of France, and for one day this summer it is going to be the centre of the cycling universe, and I can't wait. So that's the stage of Moulins, a likely sprint, but you never know with the tour. And then I think I said earlier on, this phase of the tour ends with Bourg-en-Bresse. I meant Belleville on Beaujolais. We get back into the hills for the final part of this crossing of empty France, with a very, very complicated hilly stage from Rouen to Belleville on Beaujolais. And you probably know Beaujolais well, James. It's hilly. The climbs are actually quite serious in this corner of France. They're not very well known, but there are two Cat 2s on the run into Belleville, and it's not going to be an easy stage, this one.
No, we did a similar stage in the Dauphiné this year. It's all up and down. The winds can be really strong. Surprises can happen anywhere here. Anytime we get near the Beaujolais grapevines, it's just stunning in its beauty.
I don't think many British tourists go to Beaujolais. I know a lot of the Belly Beaujolais wine goes to Britain a lot, but that's not the good stuff. I spent some time in Beaujolais. Absolutely stunningly beautiful. If I had to compare it to somewhere, I'd say it's got a bit of an air of Tuscany. It's got those rolling hills and vineyards. It's not mountainous, but it's not flat, and it's not that kind of lumpy terrain that you're talking about. And it's a part of the country that doesn't have many big cities, but it is full of character, beautiful countryside, sleepy towns, and absolutely delicious wine if you know the right ones to drink.
Absolutely. And it's easy to discount the Beaujolais because of the Beaujolais Nouveau, which is totally discountable. But there are some great wines out there.
Yeah. So that concludes phase three. I can't remember what we're up to now. We're up to phase three, aren't we? So phase four is basically the interesting bit, the Jura and the Alps. First summit finish of this part of the race is at the Col du Grand Colombier, which is just really, really hard and really, really beautiful.
It absolutely is. I remember Yvon Madiot once, which is Marc Madiot's brother, who was a pretty good rider himself. I asked him once years ago, I said, what's the hardest climb you know of? And he said, you know, there's this climb, we don't go up it very much. Not the Colombier, which is not so far from Annecy, but this thing called the Grand Colombier. And we started going up it about 10 years ago. And, you know, it's not that hot, but it just comes out of sea level, and it's pretty brutal. It's also, you know, it's one of those climbs that we find in the middle of the second week when you're really not thinking the tours in the Alps or the Pyrenees, and yet the modern Tour de France has done an amazing job of flushing out some pretty hard climbs elsewhere in the country, and this is one of them.
No rest for the wicked, because the next day to from Annemasse to Morzine, it's got three first category climbs and an all category climb, including the Col de la Ramaz, which is the penultimate climb, and the Col de Jouplan, which it's just one of those iconic tough climbs, isn't it? And made all the more complicated by the fact that you get to the top and then you've got 2 kilometres of flattish, draggish roads into the wind at the top.
Absolutely.
And then a really dangerous descent to Morzine.
It wasn't one that we went up all the time, but it was one that was, yeah, it was surprisingly hard, just for the reasons you said. That last 2 kilometres, you think you're over it, and then it's very exposed. We're not really even in the Alps yet. We're just sort of kissing them at this point. But, you know, with the Grand Colombier and the Jouplan, both of those are very hard climbs back to back.
Yeah, and then there's a third consecutive very hard day right into the Alps this time. Several very hard climbs, the Four Clouds, the Croix Frise, and then a summit finish at Saint-Gervais, which we saw a few years back, which I think Romain Bardet won at Saint-Gervais. Maybe 2017. This stage looks really, really complicated, doesn't it? It's the kind of stage where chasing's going to be hard because it's relentless climbing and descending, and some climbs are long, some are short, then there'll be a long climb and a short descent. Another little punchy climb, long descent, plateau, downhill, uphill. The profile of this stage is all over the place. And that takes us up to the rest day, which is followed immediately. We're still in the Alps by the only time trial of the tour, from Passy to Combloux, which it's got a second category climb included in it. So it's not quite a mountain time trial, is it? But it's definitely not purely for the rouleurs.
If you look on paper, it doesn't look like that steep or anything. But then you see that this little second category climb is called the Côte de Domancy. This was the climb that I believe it was the 1980 World Championships were held on, when Bernard Hinault solo to victory and just use that climb to destroy his competition lap in and lap out. And so it's got a very special place in the heart of French cycling fans. You're gonna have to get up that climb well. But by this point in the race, you know, it's also starting to become a race of reserves, a race of fatigue. So even a climber who might not be a great time trial rider, you know, if he can make the difference on that climb, he can pop a really great time trial. It'll be interesting.
The final alpine stage of this phase of the race, Saint-Gervais to Courchevel, and I would say this is the key stage of the race. It's the toughest stage. It's got the Col des Saisies, which is first category, the Cormier de Roseland, which is very, very long, also first category, very, very beautiful climb. Second category, Côte de Longuefoy, and then the climb to Courchevel and the Col de la Loz, which appeared for the first time in 2020, and I loved it. I thought it's the most amazing, varied, hard, beautiful climb that fully deserved its place on the Tour de France. They're going up and over it and then down to Courchevel again. Just looks like such a tough stage, this.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, we go over the Cormier de Roseland, which is one of my top three favorite climbs in France, just for the sheer beauty. I mean, as we go over this mountain lake, it's just exquisite. And then, yeah, that Col de la Loz, I mean, when he did it here in 2020, you know, Roglic got some time back on Pogacar, and we thought, you know, some of us thought, well, looks like Roglic has got this wrap, finally cracked his biggest threat. Turned out not to be the case, but, it happened. And I believe it was the first time we ever went up this climb. So it was, you know, one of the many new climbs that the Tour has found, which is exciting.
Yeah, that's the end of that phase of the race. The last phase is, I've imagined you called it the last bit. It's basically, there's a couple of flattish stages. One to Bourg-en-Bresse, which is famous for its chicken. James. I don't know if you knew that. And a stage de Poligny, which is a bit more lumpy and what we'd probably call, if we're being lazy cycling journalists, called a day for the break. But that one looks pretty rolling and tough, and no sprinted team's going to be able to control that one. But those 2 days are just a couple of days to get through before the final GC day of the race, which is the day in the Vosges to Marksteen, which again, none of the climbs are particularly high or particularly long, but this looks very, very tough, doesn't it?
Yeah, this could be the sleeper of the tour for sure. If somebody's got the legs, and if a team has to have the legs, then this could be a really very dangerous stage. It might be one of those stages, though, where somebody's going to have to be willing to lose to win. We've got a generation of cyclists who are willing to just throw it all to the wind.
And then we've got one final stage, the last stage to Paris, your home city, James. What are your feelings on the tour finishing in Paris? Because I know some people are down on the, in inverted commas, ceremonial final stage. Where do you sit on this?
Oh, well, I love it because I'm coming home. For me as a photographer, it's a very busy day. And yet, you know, it's a time to just sit back and kind of rejoice and savor the 3 weeks that we've just had. The riders are doing that for sure. And, you know, there's always a sense of bringing it home, bringing it full circle. The race is over. The guys know what place they're going to get. They're not going to turn the tables on the stage here.
I love the last stage into Paris. And I think it's, you know, what other sporting event can close the greatest street in the greatest city in the world. I think it's the best backdrop for the finale of the tour. We're going to take another little break now, and then we're going to come back and James and I are going to talk through a few of our memories of covering the tour in the past. There's great news for the Rouleau Conversations podcast. Our sponsor for this episode is Caldera Lab. Caldera Lab have developed an exciting range of high-performance skincare products which combine pharmaceutical-grade science with nature's purest and most potent ingredients. A leading clinical trial found that 9 out of 10 men experienced healthier and visibly improved skin after using Caldera Lab products. And we've got an exclusive offer coming up for 20% off Caldera Lab's best products. So, like most cyclists, I've spent a lot of time outdoors. Cycling keeps me young inside and very happy, but all that sun and wind does contribute to the ageing process of my skin. The laughter lines are a little more visible than they were 5 or 10 years ago. However, Caldera Labs sent me their regimen bundle, and I can already see the beneficial effect that it's having. The Clean Slate is a balancing cleanser that refreshes my skin. The base layer is a nutrient-dense moisturiser which is quickly absorbed and just makes my face feel less dry. The Good is a night cream that reduces visibility of wrinkles and fine lines, and I also look and feel a lot less tired because the Icon Rejuvenating Eye Serum has taken down those dark circles and the puffiness around my eyes. Caldera Labs are also committed to transparency, sustainability and excellence, and they are on a mission to make men's skincare better. They use clean ingredients, they are a certified B Corporation and a member of 1% for the Planet, so they're helping the world as well as the confidence of their users. Upgrade your skin and your confidence with Caldera Lab. Rouleau Conversations listeners can get 20% off at calderalab.com with our code Rouleau. And that's CalderaLab.com. Go to calderalab.com/Rouleau and that's 20% off. Unlock your youthful glow and be ready for summer with Caldera Lab. This is Rouleau Conversations. I'm Edward Pickering. I'm with James Start. We're going to talk about a few of our Tour de France memories. James, you've been covering the Tour de France for not quite as long as I've been alive, but quite a few years. Can you remember your first day on the tour?
My very first day on the tour, I was a student in Paris learning French. I came over for a summer with New York University. I didn't know anything about bike racing. And my student colleagues said, hey, we're going to go down to see the finish of the Tour de France tomorrow morning. You want to join us? And I said, sure. You know, I mean, I heard about it and I always loved riding bikes. I heard kind of about this race, but I didn't really know much about it. And I was vaguely aware of it because I remember walking down the Rue de Rennes around Montparnasse where I was living. And there was like this window of television screens. And I saw the legs of this guy just powering up the climb, some climb, maybe up to his, with the fans screaming. And I was like, wow, okay, that, there is something to this bike race, huh? So I went there and we were thinking, oh, this is going to be like a rock and roll show. You know, you got to get there early. And we're there like 8 a.m. And about the only other people stupid enough to do that were like drunk Dutch guys who were having beers at 8 a.m. on the Champs-Élysées. But we were just as stupid.
Which year was that you went to see the tour?
So it was 83. So it was Fignon's first tour. Yeah. And so I got to see them race up and down the Champs-Élysées. And that hasn't changed so much. It was still just jam-packed people, 6 deep all the way up and down. It was spectacular. Just spectacular. And then it was about a few years later, 1990, I got my first chance to actually cover the race in any way, shape, or form. So I got to see Le Mans' final victory. And that was pretty special for me as an American.
Yeah, I think my first day seeing the Tour de France live was in 1989, a mountain time trial from Gap to Orsier-Merlette. I was holidaying in the Ardèche region and persuaded my mum to go and drive us across camp on the mountainside. With a buddy of mine. Mum slept in the car and watched the mountain time trial the next day. And I'd been a cycling fan for a few years by that point. I had seen the Milk Race pass into Exeter, but this was a very different proposition. I remember seeing, as we drove through Gap the day before when the stage actually finished in Gap, obviously Gap is renowned amongst cycling journalists for being a traffic jam. There is one road in and one road out and there is no way around. And so we got stuck in the traffic jam, and I think it was Pascal Poisson, the rider for, I think he rode for Toshiba. I just saw a rider go past, and I just remember being struck by the veins in his legs and how skinny he was. And like, I was struck by this kind of colourful, real world, godlike presence of a professional cyclist after a few years following the sport. And they went up, camped on the mountainside, and watched riders come past one at a time, like from the very last rider on the GC all the way through to the top 10, cheered for Robert Miller, cheered for Sean Kelly, Stephen Rooks, final couple coming through. I think Fignon was the last three because he was in a yellow jersey at that point. It was the first time I'd ever seen the mountains, first time I'd ever seen the Tour de France. Got very, very fond memories of that day. And when the tour has gone back to Gap, I've always been stuck in the traffic jam thinking, oh, it's like, I've barely progressed since I was 16-year-old. Here I am again in a traffic jam in Gap. But that's my first memory of the tour.
I really have come to love the tours that are unpredictable and where there's suspense. And it was before my time, but the Stephen Roach Delgado one was just tremendous. Greg's victory, the 8-second victory over Fignon was, you know, huge. But in more recent years, you know, and then I came in like really right at the end of Greg's era and at the beginning of Enduren, and those were very predictable. And then we got into the, you know, late 2000s. There was 2008 after Armstrong. You know, we had some very surprising tours with, say, Carlos Sastre, and then there was winning in 2008. And then there was the one I really loved, which was 2011 when Cadel won. Thomas Voeckler had the jersey for, 10 days? And finally cracked on the last mountain stage. You know, but there was so much suspense. And Cadel was kind of racing on the back foot. The Schlecks, you know, were putting it to him. And he had to really go out and take it to him with the finish up on, I believe it was a finish up on the Galibier, that the historic finish, to kind of bring it back. And he did it just brilliantly. And I just thought that was a great one. I love that tour.
As a fan, nothing will ever surpass 1989. I think that one is so firmly cemented in my kind of memories of being a teenager, of straddling that line between being a boy and being a man and kind of growing up and becoming a bit more independent. You know, I'd finished my GCSEs. I was going on to study my A-levels. I was kind of discovering my life path a bit. And that was all wrapped up in following cycling and being at the Tour de France that year, and that year being a just incredible battle with so many stories. That there was the Fignon was on a bit of a comeback, Le Monde was definitely on a comeback, Delgado was just doing crazy things. It was a good tour for the Anglophone riders, which back then was quite important for me. It was very much a foreign sport to me, and seeing Stephen Roach winning and having Robert Miller winning stages and being himself on form again in 1989 for the first time in a few seasons, and also LeMond being involved in, you know, that it all kind of coalesced into a magical period. And then the race itself was really exciting insofar as not only did it have suspense, I mean, you know, the Giro we just saw had a lot of suspense, but there wasn't a lot of action. This was a tour that had suspense and action. The race swung back between Fignon and Le Mans so many times. Their good days and bad days exactly coincided. Like, Le Mans would have a good day, Fignon would have a bad day. Le Mans would have a bad day, Fignon would have a good day. And it just swung back and forth, topped off by that absolutely incredible time trial into Paris. And I can't see, James, that that combination of circumstances, my own life path, and the race itself will ever be surpassed.
It was that swinging back and forth that really stood out between these two. And let's not forget, I mean, they had this uncanny start where Delgado missed his start. He was the defending champion, and he showed up, what, 5 minutes late for the start. So that meant he had to just go off the Richter scale on the attacks at every opportunity, and he did. So it was this topsy-turvy thing. I mean, if you look at the 2020 tour with the final time trial or on the penultimate stage where, you know, Pogacar just raged into the victory, was brilliant. But we didn't have for 3 weeks the back and forth that of the jersey going between these guys. And that would be that's the one difference.
Yeah, tours are funny things, aren't they? Because it's very hard to judge at the time or during the race whether it's a good one or not, because you do not know till the end. As you said, with 2020, I found that tour fairly flat. I felt that Roglic was riding defensively. He was the strongest rider in the race, had the strongest team, and they rode it in the way that they had to in order to win. And suddenly, all those stages, which I found a bit kind of meh, were cast in an entirely different light by the fact of that penultimate day time trial. And I often think that you don't decide on the last day or immediately after the end of the race whether they're good or not. You can make a decision then, but you can change your opinion of a tour over the weeks, the months and the years that follow it. At the time, I didn't enjoy 2020 much, apart from the end. But having the knowledge of that penultimate day time trial definitely elevates it. And last year's tour, which for me was very much a tour of two halves. The first half was scintillating all the way up to the Col de Granon and maybe Alpe d'Huez, where it had been Pogacar just attacking and attacking and attacking and attacking and trying to take time and being exciting and aggressive. And then Vingegaard and Jumbo-Visma doing that, the attacks on the Galibier en route to the Col de Granon, which I thought was, you know, the most exciting GC stage for many, many, many years. And then after that, the shape of the race was already set. And the second half of the race kind of, for me, petered out a bit. But that's the way tours are, isn't it? You can't just put them in the exciting box or the not exciting box. There's a lot of context, a lot of development. And, you know, like a bottle of wine, they taste differently from year to year, depending on when you open them. What are the stories that have really resonated with you, the ones that you feel you've had that front row seat for, that really, but you feel have really been compelling beyond the racing, you know, into the personalities and the news stories?
I have one memory etched in my mind of the stage up to Deux Alpes in 1998, when Marco Pantani, you know, went on a long solo attack over the Galibier into the valley, put Jan Ulrich in a hole, chasing madly, and he lost the jersey dead. And Ulrich was the defending champion. We thought Ulrich was going to be the next Eddy Merckx. And it was a brutal day. It started in Grenoble. It rained the whole time up the, I think it was the Quad Fair, and I can't even remember all the climbs. And then all of a sudden, Pantani just goes wild. And he solos down this long valley and then up to Deux Alpes. And I was on a motor that day, and it was cold and it was wet. It was brutal. I mean, I remember coming over the Galibier, and I was behind the favorites, and we were passing him on the descent. And we passed Ulrich, and I could tell he was in trouble, and he didn't know what to do with his rain jacket, and he was panicking a little bit. And Pantani had just hit the foot of the Deux Alpes when we got there, and we passed him. and I got in position to start taking pictures, and I dropped back on the motorbike. But by that point, my cameras had taken in so much rain, like the flash wasn't working. It was like I was only firing about one every five shots. And I've got like one shot of him there that is really memorable to me. That's all I could come up with because it was just so emotionally packed. And you know, I got off the bike and in the press room, we were just in this tent up there, and people said, "You look blue from the cold." And yet I had experienced history. Also, let's not forget, these are tours that were so much more predictable, where the race would only happen on the last climb. And Pantani came by, and he was the first rider in years who had the courage and the imagination and the strength to go on the attack early.
Of course, you're an American journalist, you know, through the Armstrong years as well. What's your perspective on those years these days?
Well, I have a lot of perspectives on that. I knew Lance very well at a certain point during his cancer and all. And then once he won that first tour, it became a whole machine around him, very different period. But that was sort of a return to the Indurain years. I mean, he was just so dominant and his team was so dominant that there wasn't that much suspense, save 2003. If Lance had lost at least one of those tours, a little bit of vulnerability in that period would have, I think, bode well. He was so dominant, and he just dominated that generation. Obviously, we can look back at those performances with all kinds of different glasses with different filters on them and see what we want to see. But he was just such a dominant rider. But as I said from the very beginning, those kinds of tours are not the kinds of tours that I come away with that resonate in my mind.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because I started in cycling journalism in 2002, towards the end of the Armstrong years, and I didn't particularly like Armstrong, and I thought he was on drugs. I just wanted to get his career out of the way so I could crack on. And I did feel like I kind of got to grips with the tour much more from 2006 onwards, and I only went out for a few days in those early tours with Armstrong was winning. And then started covering the tour in much longer stints from 2006. I've got kind of fond but weird memories of those tours from 2006 to 2008, 2009, which were, you know, post-Armstrong years. I mean, it's when basically the sport started to pull its finger out a bit more and sort out the doping issue. But I felt like I was right in the middle of that. That was in the middle of moves and steps starting to be taken. Some riders and teams, you know, still in denial about this and still doing what they'd always done. So, you know, huge, huge stories going on. There was Puerto in 2006. 2007, I think, there was the Rasmussen year. And I remember being at the 2007 tour in one of the scrums around Michael Rasmussen before he got pulled out of the race by his team. And just remember thinking it was kind of, from a journalistic, purely objective point of view, it was exhilarating and exciting to be in the middle of that story, because it felt like the sport was finally changing from 06 through 07 to 08. Those three tours, they weren't the greatest tours in terms of the racing action. I can barely remember what happened in some of them, but I did feel like changes happened in those three tours, and I was kind of interested to be in the middle of it. What are your favourite regions of France to cover the Tour de France?
Well, could there be anything better than the Diagonal de Vide that we love so much in the Lost Center? No, I certainly have towns that I love. And for instance, I don't particularly love the Pyrenees, but I love Pau. Every time I the tour is presented, I kind of look and calculate how many days can I stay in Pau. It's just a wonderful town to host the tour. It's just big enough to have all of the teams at hotels around town. And we often have a rest day there. So you see the guys riding on the rest day through town, maybe on a coffee ride. They have restaurants that open late at night. So when you finally get off the mountain and get down to your hotel, you can have some food. It's a hot summer night. You can eat outside. I have so many great memories of Pau. And the year I retire, I think I'm going to look where the race goes to Pau and finish in Pau. And for those who missed that, I'll still be there in Paris to greet them. And then there's some, you know, a few other towns along the way that I love. Like, you know, Morzine is always a nice town. We're going there this year. And when we have a rest day there, it's always wonderful. You know, up in the mountains, but not too high. I have my favorite climbs, like the Cormier de Rousselon, that I love. Such a potpourri of memories and images. And And a lot of times I'm just riding down a road and go, oh yeah, I remember when the tour was here for this, you know. It's hard to pinpoint, but Poe's a special place for me.
Yeah. I think with me it's tied up with either the landscape or the cuisine. I must be a bit further over into deep, you know, further east from Poe in towns like Foix or Carcassonne or Castelnaudry, Limoux, because I love the cuisine. I love the Cassolet. The red wines around there, they're robust but really characterful, and it's kind of hot down there. I feel quite at home down there, although I do love the Pyrenees myself. I like forested mountains for some reason, so the Pyrenees particularly appeal to me. But I also love the southwest of France, like Périgueux and the Dordogne, just beautiful parts of the country, and you always eat very, very well there.
We agree on the French Midi. I mean, I just love the Midi. I love the Carcassonne. There was a great, brilliant race back in the day called the Grand Prix of the Midi Libre that raced through there. It was absolutely one of my favorite races ever. Towns like Albi are just gorgeous towns that you wouldn't think of, but I'm always happy when the tour goes to Albi. It's like the little Toulouse, and it's a spectacular town, and it's often, like you said, hot down there. We're going to eat well. We're going to eat outside. We're going to see friends. These are the great times of the tour.
Yeah, which, to bring it back to 2023, just to finish off, I'm most looking forward to the tour being in Moulins. I may be the only person who thinks this, but for me, on this year's route, the place that I think I will be happiest on the Tour de France will be Moulins. Where are you most looking forward to going?
Well, actually, we're going to be several days in Po. I'm pretty sure that the Dax to Nogaro stage will actually drive to Po. Yeah, we'll drive to Po that night and stay there. And then we start in Po and we'll come back to Po after Laurence and then move on. So that, you know, I do get my days in Po, which is also great because it's dirty laundry days. Anytime you can stay in a place for 2 days, you get a chance to do your laundry, which is crucial. Although it's a little early in the race here, okay?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge.
It's survival mentality, but it means a whole lot. Absolutely looking forward to this Puy de Dôme stage. It's been 33 years or 35 years. I can't remember. I've wanted to go back up there, so I'm looking so forward to that. I love the Alps. I love the Pyrenees. But I really love it when we go to some town with a small village and cross the smaller parts, the quieter parts of France.
Tour starts on Saturday. Any last thoughts before the race kicks off?
We've done all we can. We've prepared as best we can. We're coming in as good a shape as we possibly can. And I want to sit back and watch and try to relax. I mean, I get nervous before the tour, I'll be honest with you. It's day in and day out. It's grueling. You got to perform as a journalist and as a photographer every day, getting the shot, getting the quotes, getting your stories, and it's relentless. So right now I'm here in Bilbao, and it's a nice town. It's now time for a late dinner, but fortunately in Spain, I know I can eat late, unlike, say, Denmark last year, where I missed 3 out of 5 meals. So I'm going to go take a walk around town, enjoy Bilbao, and think about all the greatness that is to come.
Great. We're going to have a ton of stories going up every day on the Rouleau website, rouleau.cc, throughout the Tour de France. James is going to be out on the ground for the whole race. We're going to have various journalists from Rouleau. I'm going to be going out for a few days. Rachel Jarry will be covering the race, and we've got a cast of freelance contributors as well. Go to rouleau.cc every day for your tour coverage. Don't forget that the Tours edition of Rouleau, it's on sale now, and you can subscribe at rouleau.cc/subscribe. And get 15% off with the code podcast15. James, thank you very much. Bon voyage, bonne route, bon courage pour le Tour de France.
Thank you, Ed. And I can't wait to see you in Moulins.
I'm interrupting this podcast to remind all listeners to subscribe to Rouleau, the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Our latest edition, out now, is Rouleau 120, the Tours issue. Rouleau 120 is two magazines in one. We have two front covers, one for the Tour de France Homme and one for the Tour de France Femme, and each is packed with in-depth features about the races, their personalities, and the culture around them. Rouleau 120 features an exclusive interview and photo shoot with the double Tour winner Tadej Pogacar. In a revealing chat with Rouleau photojournalist James Start, Pogacar reflects on his journey through cycling and opens up about his relationship with the sport as a whole. Also in Rouleau 120, exclusive interviews with 5-time winner Miguel Indurain, French champion Audrey Cordon-Rageot, the fastest rising sprinter in the sport, Charlotte Accoule, plus Jean Etienne and Aurora Amaury, whose family has owned the Tour de France for generations. Also, the original voice of cycling, Phil Liggett. We also chat with Betsy King, the pioneering and irrepressible North American cyclist who raced in the Tour Féminin during the 1980s. And we've got features about the Puy de Dôme, the iconic mountain which returns to the men's tour for the first time since 1988, the Gave de Pau, which is the tour's spiritual river, the flowers of the Tour de France, and much, much more. Ruler is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture, and Ruler 120 is available now. To support our journalism and receive a magazine every 6 weeks, please subscribe. Go to ruler.cc, hit the subscribe button and enter the code podcast15, podcast15, to get 15% off our regular subscription price. You have been listening to Ruler Conversations. Ruler Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Ruler magazine. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Ruler and on Instagram at Ruler magazine, or visit our website at ruler.cc. This episode was produced by Amber Miller of Content is Queen.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.